And they're going to really miss out. Anyway, I just want to introduce myself. I'm Larry Burke. I'm a Christian here at St. Veronica's. And just want to, if you have a second, if you could just tell me about your name and then a little bit about why you're in the CIA, what brought you to the Catholic faith. And then I want to talk about my really cheery subject, You Shall Not Kill. So, Alexa, I'll be with you. I know a little bit about you, and you, so far, you're winning with the awards.
Well, that was the point. I'm Alexa Kindry. I'm actually from Arkansas, but I moved here for the job, so I've been here 5 years. I was raised Baptist, baptized Baptist, but the more I've grown, the more I've kind of questioned it and realized that there's been a lot of stuff that is left out on the Protestant side. And my parents actually converted quite a few years ago, so I'm kind of following them there, and it's just made a lot more sense to me. Kind of feels like home in a way.
Yeah. It's like when I realized when I started actually studying the faith, I kept going, oh gosh, my parents were right. They became so much smarter.
That's funny because as I study the faith, I realize my parents were wrong.
Oh.
they're still heathen Protestants, much as I've tried.
Here. He was raised Catholic. I'm from South Carolina. I was raised Baptist as well. We had an outdoor ceremony when we first got married in 2012, or actually 2009, sorry, my daughter was 2012. So it was with a Baptist preacher. So we just got our marriage co-validated this past December in the church here at St. Veronica. And that's kind of just talking with Father Dyer over all of this. It kind of made me start thinking, like, I come here every Sunday, my children attend, you know, school here, and they're being raised Catholic. And so that's why I started being cool.
That's really cool.
My name is Ray. I went to school at a Catholic university. You may have heard of it. It's the University of Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah.
kind of ended up...
I was hoping you'd do better than the ACC chart.
Yeah.
That's really cool for you guys.
Yeah. But kind of explored Catholicism there and then just really liked what I saw and just kept on looking more into it. And eventually took the plunge and decided to come to class and maybe even more serious.
Well, that's awesome. And tell me who you are.
I'm Jody. So I was raised. My mom grew up Catholic, my dad grew up Baptist, and then they decided to raise us as...
The compromise.
Yeah, the compromise. and then my fiancé, and he's Catholic.
Oh, yeah.
So, that's why he started coming out here, so I kind of just joined him and decided to take his classes too. Mm-hmm. And then to get married here in November.
That's great. A lot of you have a Protestant background, which I think is very interesting, because when I was starting to become Christian, or become Catholic again, I met this Catholic priest who was a Jesuit, and I went on a retreat with him, and it was going really terrific, but when I found out afterwards, he goes, well, he was not a very good Jesuit, he's a really strange guy, and so what he was doing is pulling people out of the Catholic Church to go to Andy Stanley, the First Baptist Church in Atlanta, the evangelical type, very charismatic guy. He was really terrific. And he would just, you know, all the Catholics come see him and go, well, you know, really got to see this Catholic church is really wrong, this, that, and the other. And my roommate, who was in the same journey with me, goes, okay. And so he convinced us to have a retreat for Catholics to convert them to be real Christians. Now, oh, this is great. But one of the things that he didn't know was that at that time, the lady who was running the retreat who really knew nothing about the Bible and the church that well. She was our youth, young adults leader. She goes, well, whatever you preach, what you guys talk about, make sure you use this new book and see what it looks like. And my So my roommate and I were like reading this stuff, and we're going, wait a minute. Father Charlie's wrong about this. Church actually teaches that. It's not what he says. And going, church really teaches about this. Really. And so we ended up challenging this guy. You know, really mad. But we went on to actually figure out what the church actually taught when we saw what the definitive teachings were. And so my friend, he's going, the church is right about everything except for contraception to Roma. So he started reading the encyclical of contraception. And it was weird. As he's reading the encyclical, he's going, oh no. What's wrong? He goes, I think the church is right about this. And he goes, I think the church is right about this. And so he's going, I'm getting really confused. I was about to leave the church. So he went and talked to one of my favorite priests, a real priest. And now my friend, who is Scott Schrodel, is now Father Lawrence Schrodel. He has joined the Franciscan Friars of Renewal. He's living a life of complete poverty in New York, working with the poor. And those people are the happiest people I've ever seen in my life. They're amazing. And they really live the Catholic faith. If you walk around with them, it's like walking around with, you know, a saint. The saintly person, people come up to them. They manage to solve, just do amazing things spiritually. I could go into stories about it. But I am supposed to talk about the commandment, thou shalt not kill. Okay, this is a really cool one, a commandment. It's, if you look, God arranges things, right? You know, he's God. And so, you have the Ten Commandments. Verse 3. You know, respecting God, keep holy Sabbath, don't take my name in vain, and don't have any false idols, right? So the first three, respecting God. The fourth one is respecting your parents who created life, honor that mother and father. And then you kind of have that, what's important for us in our living, our behavior, and the headstone of that is, thou shall not kill. And so we want to kind of explore this. The Catholic Church takes a really cool look at this, and it goes against what's happening in our society today. Our society today is something that John Paul II, St. John Paul II, called the culture of death, which is everywhere. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about the Catholic Church. It goes against the culture of death. Jesus Christ said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Today we're going to talk about what happens when you don't follow the way, the truth, or the life. This commandment embodies Christ himself and rejects the life. And it rejects the life that God has given us. Hey! So we're going to talk about the very first death in the Bible. Who knows what that is? Very first death. No, Scott, he's really cool. So, very first death is Cain and Abel. Who are Cain and Abel? They're the sons, the twin sons of Adam and Eve. And what's interesting is Cain took was in charge of, they kind of bifurcated the work. Cain, you take care of the fields, and Abel, you take care of all the animals. And so, but then they, to honor God, they sacrifice to God. And this is what happened. So Abel brought the firstlings of his flock and other fat portions. And God had regard for Abel's offering. So God liked what Abel had to give. But then Cain and his offering, God didn't like. So Cain was really angry. This is the key. And his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry and why has your countenance fallen? And this is what God said. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you don't do well, sin is crouching at the door, is desirous for you, but you must master it. Cain said to his brother, let us go out to the field. And when they were both in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? And you know, God is God. He already knows the answer to this, right? It's not like he didn't know. And Abel said, Cain said, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you have cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You'll be a fugitive and wanderer of the earth.
Cain said to God, my punishment is too great, I can't bear it. Behold, thou hast driven me this day from the ground, and from the face I shall, from your, thy face I shall be hidden. And I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer of the earth, and whoever finds me may slay me. Then God said to him, not so. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken of him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone who came upon him should kill him. Then Cain went off from the presence of God and dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Eden. In Evangelium Vitae, which, as we all know, our Latin means Gospel of Life, St. John Paul II said, God drove Cain out of his presence and sent him into exile far away from his native land, which was essentially next to Eden. So he passed from a life of human kindness to one of which is more akin to a rude existence of a wild beast. God, who preferred the correction rather than the death of a sinner, did not desire that a homicide be punished by the exaction of another homicide. So, you know, essentially God wanted to reform, you know, his son Cain, because, you know, even though he committed a sin, he didn't want to he wanted to be aware of his guilt and to repent. A thief comes to steal and slaughter, but I came that they may have life and have it to more abundance, which is John 10:10. The blood cries out. Even blood drained has a special significance. Human blood has a significance. If you ever watched the Catholic television network, EWTN, the founder of the network is named Mother Angelica. She died a few years ago. But I saw her a couple times when I lived in Georgia and drove over to Alabama to see her show. And she told this really funny story about when she was a novice and she was in had to have an operation. But she had the operation, and then there was all sorts of complications, left her crippled, and she had to have complete blood transfusion. And so she was telling this story to in Alabama. In Alabama, they had, I believe at the time, a 2% Catholic population. So there wasn't a huge amount of Catholics there. But she had to raise money for her convent. And she is of cloister order, so they gave her permission to go out and speak to folks. So she went out to speak to a group of Jewish businessmen. And, this is kind of interesting. A Catholic cloister nun speaking to Jewish businessmen. And she was saying to him, you know, when I had this operation and I survived it, I wanted to see who helped me survive it. And I saw on my chart the name of the person who gave me blood. His name was Mike Eisenberg. And so ever since I got that blood, I haven't been the same since. So she had Jewish blood in her at that point. And they loved it so much that they gave her, boom, you know, a lot of money to help build her convent, which I thought was really terrific for them to help her. But the idea that blood carries significance, and that this idea that the crying out for justice is something that God that the blood does. But it's interesting. There are sins that cry out to heaven for vengeance and for justice. There's four in the Bible. One is the blood of Abel, crying out. In other words, killing someone unjustly who is righteous and innocent. The second one is the sin of the Sodomites, Sodom and Gomorrah, cried out for God's justice. The next is the cry of the oppressed. And the fourth one is injustice to wage earners. And, you know, there's a level, as you can see, much more for innocence being killed for God crying out. And then the other ones are next on the list on down. So let's talk about legitimate defense in killing. You know, this is all about killing, the Fifth Commandment. Now, can you kill somebody? And yeah, there are reasons you can kill someone. Love of oneself justifies using violence against an aggressor to stop them from harming you or someone else. Use of force needs to be proportional relative to the threat. For example, if a mom saw a bully hit her son, she shouldn't. She should restrain or stop the bully and not shoot him. And that would be considered not a proportional use of a lethal force. Lethal force can be appropriate, and sometimes a duty to use it lethal force if that's the only alternative to protect yourself or from someone else. Someone's trying to stab you with a knife, and all you can do is shoot him. you may have to shoot them. In fact, you probably have an obligation to shoot them or stop them and use deadly force, because they're going to harm you, and you have an obligation for you to protect yourself and protect others. Intentional homicide, this is next category. And then getting back to our study, Cain and Abel, direct and intentional murder of an innocent person is always cries out to heaven for vengeance. Cooperating with murder is wrong. Putting someone in a situation that creates mortal danger without grave reason is wrong. Refusing to help someone in mortal danger is wrong. I'm going to tell you a story about a situation in 1964. I mean, none of you were around in 1964. But in New York City, there was a young lady named Kitty Genevieve. And she was worked at a bar in New York. And she got off late one night, was walking home. And this creepy guy named Winston Mosley followed her back to her apartment. Well, he tried to, assault her sexually, and she screamed. And he stabbed her a couple times. And so she had an apartment that, it was sort of a big building with sort of a U-shaped, so kind of a big courtyard there. And he attacked her in this courtyard as she was trying to get to one of the doors. And so she was wounded, and she was trying to get into the courtyard, but her keys were not with her for whatever reason, and she couldn't get into it. Well, this Winston Mosley was kind of hanging around, he wanted to kind of see the cops and everyone come and see all the commotion. So he came back, you know, like 20 minutes later, and there was nothing. She was out there screaming, yelling for help. Nothing was happening. So he came and he finished the sexual assault, and then he stabbed her to death while she's screaming. Well, this building, you can picture a New York building in the 60s, they didn't have air conditioning. It was really hot. All these windows were open. Everybody could hear what was going on. Nobody responded, and she died. This is an idea, an example of what they call bystander syndrome. They had another similar thing, I think it was in New Jersey, where a lady was sexually assaulted on a subway train recently in the last couple months, and nobody raised a finger to help her. She's being sexually, so I mean, it's just really just amazing things that can happen. So there's sort of a cascading, I don't want to get involved, I don't want to get help. That can be considered a grave, not helping someone who's in mortal danger, not taking the time. There was a neat video I saw on YouTube where they showed this guy who had, he looked rather shabby, could have been homeless, but he collapsed in a subway staircase. And people were just, like walking over him, going, and nobody was paying attention. And so the camera showed this for a few minutes. And then all of a sudden, this one guy stops, goes, oh my gosh, helps him up, tries to get him out. And then all of a sudden, everybody starts helping him. And then you find out later that the people who were helping him, helped him financially, and helped him with food, helped him get a place to stay afterwards. So at first, people were ignoring him, bystander syndrome, and then it was sort of cascading kindness, because one person set the example of how to treat and how to respond to these situations. See, unintentional killing is not morally reputable unless circumstances that brought about the actions or inactions should not have happened. For example, someone dies while hit by a car when the driver's been texting. Aggressive driving could be another way. Not paying attention to the doses of medicine. It's like that's the most famous one I remember is It's a Wonderful Life. Have you ever seen that movie? They had a scene in there where Mr. Bailey as a young child is working in the pharmacy, and the pharmacist's son has just died of not sure what he died of, but his young son just died, and he was so distraught that he'd been drinking. And he started filling prescriptions while he was drinking, and George Bailey noticed that. Oh my goodness, he just put the lethal dose of pills into this lady's stuff. And he was told to deliver that to her. He didn't do it because he knew it was lethal. And then he went up to George Bailey and slapped him on the ear. And his head was all bleeding. And then he said, he started beating him up. And then he said, why didn't you do it? And he goes, because you put the wrong stuff in here. And then he went and looked at it and goes, Oh, wow. And that changed that guy for life, saved his life. But he pointed out that he was not paying attention to what he should have been paying attention to. And that is an intentional killing. And he would be responsible for that, even though he didn't need to do it. Now, I'll get to the big elephant in the room is abortion. Am I my brother's keeper? Which is a perverse view of freedom. Human life must be respected from the moment of conception, which is Catechism section 2270, and have the full rights and protection of every human being. Since the first section, the Church has forbid abortion and infanticide. This has been the constant teaching of the Church. One often hears the objection that the Bible doesn't address the question of abortion, and if that is such a great evil, why is it in there? When Christians permeated the Roman society in the first century, they encountered the culture of death that included abortion. One of the earliest Christian extra-biblical documents is called the Didache, or Teachings. The full name is the Teachings of the Apostles, and it defines abortion as murder. But this is a really cool document. It came, this close to making it into the Bible, but I don't really know who the author was. So it was essentially the first catechism of the Church. But it taught a lot of things like baptism, how to be baptized, the sprint dunkle or poor. That was a controversy. It was a controversy today. And so, how do we do it? It's not in the Bible, isn't fully defined how it is. It teaches all about these things the early Church, or that the churches today have questions about. It's a fantastic document. It was lost for centuries. I think it was found in the last, 150 years, 70 years?
Something like that, yeah.
And then,
there were references to it, but we didn't have the original, and then we found it.
Right. So it's here's the seminal document that references to abortion, to all sorts of infanticide, lots of things that were, and these evils are starting coming up, and they're saying, well, it's not part of the Christian faith, because, it's not in the Bible, therefore you Catholics can't be teaching it, and we're going, it's part of the tradition, always has been, and voila, here it is. Here is the Didache. There you go.
It's pretty short, too. You can go read it in, an hour or less.
Beautiful document. Formal cooperation with helping someone obtain an abortion is a grave offense. Here again, it is bystander syndrome. When someone asks or is contemplating an abortion, and the person gives the response, I don't want to get involved, it's their choice, I'm against this, and would never impress my religious views on someone else. They have to do what is right for them. If we stand idly by when murder takes place, are we like the people in Queens in 1964? Well, it's an interesting question. I don't know. There was a great interview with in public where Mother Teresa, now Saint Teresa of Calcutta, was being interviewed when she was in the U.S. And so the press was not exactly had full Christian values, and so they said, "Well, Mother Teresa, what are you going to do with all these unborn babies that are born in the U.S.? Of course, they have to be aborted." You know what her answer was? She said, give me all the babies. I will take all of the babies. You go, wow, that is a great answer. Say, I'm going to use that answer someday. And it actually happened to me. I had a coworker who everyone knew my views on life. And so she was 40 years old, not married, was going to have a baby. And she told everyone but me. And she decided to tell me. And she hasn't decided what she was going to do with her pregnancy yet, whether she's going to kill her child or not. So she came to me and said, oh, I'm going to have a baby. What should I do? In other words, should I abort it or keep it? And I told her, it's Mother Teresa's answer, give it to me. I'll take your baby. Well, she ended up having the baby, and things turned out well. But it was definitely a test. How do we have to be able to respond? What a gift, though. A baby? That would have been really cool. I don't like that. The canonical penalty of excommunication goes with abortion because it harms the child, the parents, and society as a whole. you know, if I've always been, you know, when we talk about the culture of death, which I started off with, it always amazes me kind of the weird stuff associated with it. I don't know if you ever prayed in an abortion clinic. When I was with my friend who's now a priest, we, a group of our friends, would go and pray in abortion clinics. And what we would do is we were trained to talk to the ladies walking in there to hopefully maybe have an effect to save the child. And so what my friend did was, they had so many people blocking us, and he went long loops around because people wanted to sneak into that place. And he found where all the abortion workers parked their cars. And what was strange is they had these bumper stickers. My other car is a broom. Love your mother. And a picture of the earth. It was all Wicca, witchcraft kind of stuff that these ladies were into, which, you know, is really terrible. Electing politicians, and this is, you know, what we have a duty to. If we elect politicians who bring about positive laws enacting abortion without proportional reasoning goes against Catholic teaching. What does that mean, proportional reasoning? What that means is that if you have a guy who's real, you know, pro-abortion guy, and you have one who's not, you should vote for the one who's not pro-abortion, because this guy's killing people. But if you have two that are pretty much close in the abortion realm, but this one's slightly better than the other one, you can vote for the lesser of the two evils. But it's not so much like this guy's going to give his pro-abortion, gives money to the poor, and this one, you know, is not, it doesn't give, is pro-life, but he doesn't want to give as much money to the poor, then that doesn't balance out. I know I feel bad because I have a close family member who is an attorney and was, you know, the president of, chairman of Catholic Charities, and this person was telling me, oh, I know, is just totally is become pro-abortion, and I asked her about it, and I said, how can you do that? And she goes, oh, I take the full Catholic position, helping the poor. It's okay if a little bit of abortion goes on over here, but I'm helping the poor. He's going, this is not going to go well for her long term. She has that. Medical procedures that violate the dignity of the unborn, procedures such as prenatal tests for the purpose of eugenics, are wrong. If you're familiar with the term eugenics, that means good birth. In other words, you get rid of anything that's not perfect. There is a movement in the early part of the 20th century. It spawned out of Darwin. In fact, eugenics was termed by a biologist who was the first cousin or second cousin of Charles Darwin, basically saying that with the theory that if we can get rid of the people who are less smart, and they attribute that to certain races to be less smart, that they would that the world would be a better place, because we would have good births, eugenics, at that point. And so that was, you know, Margaret Sanger who started Planned Parenthood. That her whole premise was start out with eugenics. We've got to make the world more perfect by killing people that aren't who we want them, who we like. Likewise, the production of embryos for experimentation or the use of children for spare parts is immoral. There's something called a savior baby. I don't know if you've ever heard that term. But some couples will have an extra baby in order to have spare parts for another child or person in the family that they think they need it, or they'll grow an embryo to a certain extent to, and then harvest parts. It's considered gravely immoral to do that. Manipulation of the, here's another interesting fact. People aren't perfect. In Denmark, I believe it's, or Iceland, they have required, I think, women to have abortions if they have Down syndrome genes. And so NPR, many years, about 3 or 4 years ago, did a story, and they wanted to see how dumb women were in the U.S., or families were in the U.S., that found out that they had a child with Down syndrome, and they were pregnant with it, and ended up having the baby anyway. How stupid would that be? So they commissioned a survey to figure out the damaging effect of having a Down syndrome baby would be on society. And so what they found out was that, that's not true. Down syndrome children may have incredibly special qualities of empathy and of relating to people that no other child or children don't have, and that families that have them are incredibly blessed. So they're known as, my father's an OBGYN, and he said, yeah, we used to call the families that had them happy children, or the happy families, because the children made the families much, much stronger. So I had a client whose son has Down syndrome. He works at Harris Teeter in Charlotte. So NPR decided to interview him, like do an ambush interview while he was working and putting the carts back at Harris Teeter. So they go up to him, and the reporter didn't buy into the findings of the study that they had done. So the reporter goes up to the guy, his name is Brendan, and says, hello, Brendan, I'm with NPR. I wanted to know if I could talk to you. And Brendan goes, hello, very nice to meet you. What do we want to talk about? And he goes, well, Brendan, I want to talk to you about a lady. And what would you say to a lady who's pregnant and just found out her son has got Down syndrome? Right? And so little Brendan goes, well, first of all, I'll say to her, congratulations, and you are really going to enjoy your child. I mean, it just, I love listening to that interview. I mean, the whole world shattered when Brendan tore that guy apart with just his few simple, innocent words. He's a great kid. Manipulation of the genetic code for creating children with certain qualities is immoral. This is not correcting defects, but fixing, making things different. There's a great movie called Gattaca. Have you ever seen that movie, Gattaca? It has Ethan Hawke, Jude Law, and Uma Thurman in it. It's an all-star movie. It's considered probably the best science fiction movie that was never really, to make a lot of money. But it starts off with the movie. It's really cool. Did you see it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Well, it starts off with the movie. The very beginning, you have you're in a delivery room, and these two operating nurses are talking behind a barrier, looking through a glass at a woman on a table in the throes of labor. And they're going, oh, my gosh, I think that baby was probably conceived in the back of a car. And this lady is, we know, is just totally screwed up because she's praying a rosary. Oh my gosh, the lady's a Catholic. This is terrible. And of course, the baby was not genetically modified. She had a natural baby. And they, as soon as the baby comes out, stick him, run his DNA, look at the DNA. Oh my gosh, he won't have a perfect heart later on in life. What a disaster. So the baby is branded as being a defect. And society treats him like a defect. But move forward 3 or 4 years, and the lady is now throwing away the rosary beads. Now she's enlightened. We've got the big flat screen computer, and it's got, four away posts, four different embryos up there. They go, these two are the best ones. In fact, we can straighten this one out a little bit more, make it a little smarter, fix his teeth, make it a little bit taller, a little bit stronger. We'll enhance that one. So we went with that baby. So she had to design her baby at that point. So the rest of the movie is the story of two sons, one who is natural and one who is genetically modified. And who's going to struggle to survive? Who's going to be the winner? Or who's going to be how society going to treat them? It's a really cool movie, talking about that. But that's the idea of it's immoral manipulating genetic code for non-therapeutic reasons. Euthanasia. Deliberate act of killing someone who is handicapped, sick, or dying is immoral, unacceptable. World War II example. The Nazis, when they moved into Austria, the Austrians welcomed them in when they supposedly took over, and they gave them food, they convinced the kids that they needed to go to fun summer camp. And they basically said, we're going to take care of all the sick children. So the sick children were they've got fantastic doctors. So they would go to the children that are handicapped. They would bring a beautiful ambulance up to them. And they would load the children into the ambulance. We'd say, we're taking them to our special medical facilities. We're going to help them with this handicap. We believe we can cure them. And if you're a mom or dad, you're going, go for it. This is great. So they took the children away. What they didn't know was that the Nazis had taken the exhaust and pumped it into the back of the cabin. So that by the time the kids arrived, wherever they arrived, they were already dead. They killed all the handicapped children, part of the, you know, what they considered to be mercy killing. Yeah, I'm really cheerful. Let's see. Euthanasia can also include acts of remission that causes death, which is contrary to God's law. Discontinuing medical procedures that are burdensome, dangerous, or extraordinary, or disproportionate is legitimate. This is refusal of overzealous treatment, where death is accepted. I like the death of John Paul II, if you ever read about that. But he found out that as he was dying, or in the last days of his life, all the doctors were there. And one of the doctors was looking at him and just said, "Oh, your veins are starting to collapse. It's going to start affecting your organs. We can do this, that, or the other." And he just goes, "No. Let it continue." And he knew what was happening and didn't want to have what we call overzealous treatment. If death is intimate, painkillers decreasing suffering is allowed, even if the medication shortens the life of the person. In this case, medication is for easing suffering rather than quickening death, which is important today, because a lot of times for this euthanasia is they're going to suffer, therefore we need to kill them. This brings me to my first article. How many of you saw Little House on the Prairie? Remember Little House on the Prairie? You ever seen that? You heard it? Yeah. Well, here's a story about Michael Landon, who was in the show. Michael Landon, the hugely popular television star of Bonanza, Little House on the Prairie, and Highway to Heaven, died in 1991 at age 54. Landon's last act, if you will, was wildly hailed as his best. He publicly announced his diagnosis with terminal pancreatic cancer. He appeared on the Tonight Show to openly discuss his pending death with Johnny Carson, almost unprecedented back then. He gave several interviews announcing his determination to hang on to the very end. He told Life magazine, "If I'm going to die, death's going to have to do a lot of fighting to get me." Landon's grit and determination inspired the nation. When he died a few months later, praise for his unshrinking courage led to the obituary saying, "Goodbye, Little Joe," and people exemplifying his media approach. As words of his condition spread, thousands of letters of encouragement and sympathy arrived daily. Scores of friends visited the house and stood vigil at the gates of the ranch. "I have X amount of energy," Landon said, "and what I want to spend with my family." Landon's youngest children, Sean, age 4, Jennifer, 7, were emotionally distraught, says longtime friend and business partner Kent McCleary. But Landon passed away with strength, passing his strength along to them, according to his colleague, John Warren. Landon also spent time dictating his last wishes to his family. His friends and family had solace. It was Landon's extraordinary calm, says Flynn, of his old friend's last hours. "It was like going off a diving board. He knew it was coming, and he was brave to the last." Attitudes have changed about the disease and death since then, and in my view, not for the better. Indeed, today, many might secretly consider Landon a chump for choosing to struggle until his natural death. If that seems harsh, maybe we should go on to consider international media's swoon over 29-year-old Brittany Nader, who announced her plans to commit assisted suicide, legal in Oregon, where she moved from California after being diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Nader is the subject of a well-planned PR campaign orchestrated by George Soros-funded assisted suicide advocacy group called Compassion and Choices, formerly known as the Hemlock Society. Compassion and Choices press release lauded Maynard's courage to tell her story as she is dying and alert all Americans to the choice of death with dignity as selfless and heroic. It's one thing for special interest advocacy groups to spin Maynard's story in its ideological direction, to be sure. Maynard is cooperating in that endeavor. But it is odd how eagerly the media has picked up this narrative of courage and heroism. There has been more than 700 assisted suicide in Oregon, and none, not even the first one, received attention being devoted to reporting Maynard's situation. it is more striking how the reporting about Maynard's decision to die resembles the reporting about Landon's courage 23 years earlier. For example, People, which lauded Landon for fighting to the end, now had the mirror opposite take on Maynard. It even made her cover story. For the past 29 years, Maynard has lived a fearless life, running half marathons, traveling through Southeast Asia for a year, and even climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. So it's no surprise that she is facing death the same way. On Monday, Maynard will launch an online video campaign with nonprofit Compassion and Choices, an end-of-life choices advocacy organization, to fight for expanding death with dignity nationwide. Suicide has made Maynard an international celebrity. Partly, that's because she is the perfect icon. Young, pretty, newlywed, tragically dying, and transgressive for wanting to kill herself rather than face the rigors of late-stage brain cancer. But that alone doesn't explain why she has received the kind of high-profile attention usually reserved for movie stars, rock stars, and presidential candidates. She's been the subject of stories Time, Time, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, USA Today, CNN, PBS, TBS, and so on. I mean, you know you've hit the big time when Rosie O'Donnell balls you on The View. But what if Maynard followed Landon's death path instead? She's still pretty young, newlywed, tragically dying, but would have no cover stories of People or applause from Rosie O'Donnell. In fact, we would never heard of her. That speaks volumes about the state of our culture. If assisted suicide is now considered courageous and equates with death with dignity, doesn't it apply to people like Landon who choose to fight against the dying of the light are undignified and perhaps less courageous? Maynard isn't nihilistic. She was just scared. Those using her tragedy for their own purposes, policy advocacy groups, ratings, internet hits, etc., can't say the same. The words of Canadian journalist Andrew Coyne keep ricocheting in my ears. A society that believes in nothing can offer no argument even against death. A culture that has lost its faith in life cannot comprehend why it should endure. Don't worry, I've got more cheery stories to come. But no, I thought that was amazing. I don't know if you remember that Maynard, the story about her. Okay, next is suicide. Everyone is a steward of their own lives. They don't own it. This is a really important concept in Catholicism. You don't own your own life. You're a steward of your body and taking care of it. You're a steward of helping other people. It's not something that you can take and destroy or damage. They don't own it. God does. He gave each of us the gift of this life. We're in charge of taking care of our own lives. We're not free to take our lives. It offends the law to love our neighbor, as we love ourselves, and is against the concept of self-love. It breaks the ties of families, nations, and other organizations that depend on us. Suicide can set an example to others on how to deal with problems and can lead to a contagion and a scandal. We don't know the salvation of anyone who commits suicide. That is in God's hands. Those who fall into suicide often have grave psychological problems. And now we have the poll. Top poll for the day. What is the what profession in England has the most suicides? Alex, you probably know this because you're world traveling, but who are the others? Anybody know? Well, yeah, tell me your name again. Sorry, I'm Larry Burke.
Scott.
It's another Scott. Ray, do you know?
I would guess attorney.
Close. No, actually it's not attorney. Getty? Melinda?
Doctor.
Close. What kind of doctor? Jody? It's vets. What do vets do with their patients that are sick?
Euthanize
them. My dog was had a heart attack last October, and she was dying. And so we brought her to the doctor, and And at first they misdiagnosed it. And I don't know if you've ever been through this with a dog, but and they charge you gazillions of dollars to tell you, yep, got here a little bit late. And well, what can we do for the dog? Well, we can give her a shot and she'll be gone. That's the X number, $100. And I go, well, can we do something else for the dog? Well, you know, you could give her painkillers and keep her comfortable, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then they say, how's the dog doing? Well, she's doing it. She's not doing well, but she's doing, painkillers seem to be working. You know, you can bring her in, we can give her a shot. You're going, why do you keep trying to bring me in to kill my dog? I don't get that. It just seems really weird. The solution is suicide. And you'll see it coming. It's like you know, you have a legalized abortion and all sorts of other perversities, and you've got suicide and euthanasia coming right down the road after it. Respect for the dignity of persons. And then, so part of this is respect for others is scandal. What does scandal do? Leading someone else into sin is a scandal. This is a grave offense and often leads to spiritual death. When leaders and teachers who are responsible for imparting wisdom don't do it, but instead create scandal, Jesus said, whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in him to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone was tied around his neck and he drowned. Political leaders who enact and legalize immoral laws and those who elect them create scandal when they enact laws that codify the culture of death. Yeah, that was interesting. If you've been following these school controversies, if you read about what's going on in these schools, it's essentially sexual grooming of little children. It's nothing weird, nothing good about it. I was working with one of the preachers here at St. Veronica's, was one of the two conservative members of the Fairfax County School Board. And you know, he gave me pretty good insight about what's going on there. So if you, I mean, this is kind of graphic, but do it with fifth graders. Fifth graders get to learn about what male, two men together would do for a sexual act and show a film about it. They teach young girls how to, how should we say, do unnatural acts on men in seventh grade. My son goes to George Mason, and one of his classmates, who was 2 years behind him, was describing her orientation class. So orientation class, anybody you guys know Mason? Was this. They had stage, here's a whole freshman class. And if you have a classman on stage teaching stuff, doing skits, so you learn really well. So they had a male and a female, and they're on stage undressing themselves. And what's the message? The message is to be responsible with your sex life. And how do you be responsible with your sex life? Have no more than four sexual, different sexual partners a week, and know them for 24 hours before you get into the room. If you do the math, 52 weeks in a year, 4 years, you slept with your whole class. You see why different every time. Can you? You're teaching this to the freshmen? You know, talk about putting a millstone around someone's neck and teaching them what's wrong. You know, we're killing our kids with the education system. That's why it's so important for the Catholic Church to be teaching as the Catholic Church teaches. What is the truth? And that's why there's such a big backlash because they're learning about it. And we saw in L.A. There were two teachers who recruit for for classes or for clubs that are promoting their transgenderism or being gay. And they target kids. The kids that are, you know, they're a little bit different, they're awkward, don't get along. They look at their internet posts that they use during class to see if they show any interest in a subject, and then they have a special way of inviting them to this special class to make them feel great, special club. But we don't tell the parents about it. It's completely sick what they're doing. You know, I call it sexual grooming. And the people, when I went to look at the a special group, because they wanted to take the word male and female out of the curricula in Fairfax County and put in non-gender names for boys and girls. You know, I wanted to see what the promotion was, what the all-star panel was that would be discussing this. And the all-star panel was led by this very charismatic gay attorney from Maryland, who basically threw down any kind of objection that somebody threw up and just rewrote the whole thing the way he wanted to have it rewritten, which was in a very inappropriate way. I think we would even say things like, that 7-year-olds should be getting, should be counseled to have gender reassignment teachings and start taking hormone shots. And then people raise their hands going, whoa. You'll destroy their sexual organs if you do that. You'll destroy their growth. You'll destroy all these things in them. This is what's best for them because they're in the wrong gender, they're in the wrong body. You've got to fix that. This is what they're teaching. It's so scandalous. And then if you look at the curriculum, I can go into it all day, but we need to look into it. We need to correct our society. And I know parents are starting to take action now, but there is full onslaught against it. And it's interesting. If you enact a law for something that's weird, people accept that to be correct. If you look at the attitudes about traditional marriage versus gay marriage, 15 years ago or 10 years ago, you enact the law, the attitudes change almost instantly. Let's see, respect for health. Health is a gift from God, and we're stewards of our own bodies, which take reasonable care. Society should help in creating conditions where people can grow and reach maturity. Society should help with food, clothing, care, education, social assistance, employment. It's interesting, during the feudal days, for our historians around here, and of course you've been to Europe, you know all about the feudal system. Lexi knows can lecture us here in just a second. But in the feudal system, essentially you had the barons and you had the people who worked the yard, who worked their farms. And if you didn't work them, you're kind of treated quite a bit like slaves. The church used to protect them. It had things like rules about when you can send them to war, rules when they can work, they get Sundays off, and then they had feast days. What's cool about feast days is you don't work on a feast day. You get a feast day off. Church protected them, made sure that they had food, and so forth. It's this idea of society needs to protect its the people that are around it. In the early 1800s, Catholic Church was not very good in various immigrant cities, especially New York. And New York in the 1840s to the 1860s was flooded with the dreaded Irish. Me was there. I was there coming in. And the Irish were terrible in terms of poverty, killing, gangs, alcoholism. Everything was terrible about it. Kids were dying. They lived in filth. The slum lords were all over the place. And guess what happens? Everybody here serves St. Patrick. The British born, the Irish don't like that. Missionary who celebrated on St. Patrick's Day created Christianity to Ireland. One proud Irish descendant came to America. He was named John Joseph Hughes. You probably haven't heard of him, but he was one of the most important men in history, if not the entire world. An Irish immigrant gardener, eventually ordained to the Catholic priesthood. His nickname was Dagger John. Because he had, as he was called this, the habit of punctuating his signature with a dagger-like cross and behaving with a similar aggressive flair, became the first Archbishop of New York. He served between 1842 and 1864, a time of explosive Irish Catholic growth in America. According to a report covering him during this tenure, the city's Catholic shepherd, He was more Roman gladiator and a devout follower of meek Christianity. The Protestant convert who immigrated to from Ireland at age 20. Hughes had his initial application for the priesthood rejected. Church leaders deemed him uneducated and ignorant. Irish. Charges that couldn't have been further from the truth. In fact, he was brilliant, resourceful, traits that would later come in handy in his long, productive ministry. Hughes made his mark as an eloquent orator, speaking persuasively against religious bigotry. At the time, prejudice against newly arriving immigrants, especially the Irish, was rampant. In 1838, at age 40, Hughes was transferred to New York, where he was appointed to the role of co-adjutant bishop. His assignment couldn't have been more fraught with difficulty. Writing in the City Journal, a publication of the Manhattan Institute, New York-based think tank, Sean Stern described the debauchery and the general cultural chaos found throughout the city, especially in those areas populated by the dreaded, horrible Irish. According to Stern, family life had disintegrated in a wave of immorality that included the proliferation of rampant gangs, alcoholism, prostitution, robbery, mob violence. Over half the people arrested in New York were Irish. So those police vans were dubbed paddy wagons. An episode of mob violence in the streets were called Donnybrooks, after a town in Ireland. He continued, death was everywhere. In 1854, one out of 17 people in the Sixth Ward died. In Sweeney's Shambles, the rate was one of 12 over one out of five in a 22-month period. So you have a 20% death rate over just under 2 years for the Irish. The death rate among Irish families grew to 21% annually, while among non-Irish it was 3%. Life expectancy for New York Irish immigrants averaged under 40 years. Tuberculosis, when Bishop Hughes called the natural death of the Irish immigrants, was the leading cause of death, along with drinking violence. This is a horrendous scene to which the new bishop waited. One can only imagine what went through his head. What did he do? For starters, he decided to build from scratch a Catholic school system, believing that the future of the city will be founded in the character and intellect of its children. In our age, the question of education, he said, is the question of the church. He wanted schools to stand out from their secular counterparts. In addition to a strict but standard curriculum based on classical education model, the participants in the care and upkeep of the school, Hughes would eventually expand his pioneering efforts with the college level, founding Fordham University as well as Manhattanville, and Mount St. Vincent Colleges. The bishop was considered to be the most effective and influential engaging New Yorkers in the pulpit and on the street with straightforward spiritual perspective. He regularly preached on the need for personal transformation, encouraged faithful to assume individual responsibility for their actions, and realize the benefits of discipline in biblical lives. Hughes also made scriptures relevant. The simple principle of right and wrong were stressed, which, though obvious in hindsight, seemed to have been forgotten, or at least regularly ignored. By all accounts, Hughes preached a simple and positive message of faith, hope, and love New Yorkers seemed to live. The success of his efforts were stunning. Alcohol and drug use dropped. Irish neighborhood, once known for violence, became bastions of peacefulness. Membership and participation in the church rose dramatically. In a short period of time, the city had been transformed, not by fiat or fire or brimstone, but through deliberate, disciplined efforts of a man whose main goal was to change the culture by reforming hearts and minds in and through the name of Jesus Christ. But here was Hughes' real secret. He didn't simply preach them. He talked with them like a father to a son. The effort of his direct and gracious approach is still being felt today. Experts have suggested that Bishop Hughes failed in his attempt to reform the Catholic Irish Church in New York. Experts suggest that had the bishop failed in his attempt to reform the church and Irish culture, the future of American immigration, and thus America itself, would have been drastically altered. It seems reasonable to discount this action, this example of cultural transformation, as something other than an error, but to dismiss it so quickly would be a grave mistake. Those committed to redeeming the current culture can find practical application and inspiration in the works of Dagger John. I thought that was cool. Right, Ray? Dagger John? Notre Dame? Irish?
Yeah, fighting Irish.
That is awesome. Yeah, but when it gives an example, it's like, what is true Catholic culture and transformation to society? And are we really teaching it? And the church, especially this little book, you know, really teaches what the church actually says. There's a really cool friend of mine who was a convert from, he was started off as Southern Baptist, and then he worked for, actually, Andy Stanley's church. And his job was to go to South America and convert the Catholics to become good Christians. Well, he decided to actually look into the teachings of the church, the history of the church, the early church, and he found that boy. He says, Catholic stuff has got something going for him. And they challenged him at the First Baptist Church as he was on staff, and nobody can answer his questions. He goes, gosh, you know, I got to do something because I can't be Baptist. And so I'm going to become Episcopalian. So he became Episcopalian. And he goes, well, you know, I'd like to become Catholic, but there aren't really any Catholics, because all the Catholics I know that I like died 1,100 years ago. And then he found out that people actually do follow the teaching of the church. And so that guy's now a fairly well-known author. He's really teaching what the church can do, what it needs to do. And if you follow the history of the church, you probably have church history already, but you'll see the cycles where the church gets weaker and then it gets stronger. It builds up Europe, and then Europe becomes much, much stronger. So that's what we're here to do. You guys coming into the church, really follow the teachings of the church after, of course, this terrific lecture about killing. And we can transform, help restore society. Let's get into some fun topics here. The cult of the body. This is a disordered view of health. Worshipping the body is a neo-paganistic practice that emphasizes physical perfection and success of sports. It emphasizes perfection of the body and the strong leading to a perverse diversity of human relationships. And there's various different types of things. Have you ever seen the movie Million Dollar Baby with Clint Eastwood? Tell us about that movie.
The female boxer, and she gets hurt in the hospital, and she eventually passes, right? But she tries to do it herself.
And she gets Clint to do it.
Yeah.
So she was like the best boxer, technique-wise. And then in a fight with, you know, the most devastating boxer who cheated, she has her neck broken. So she goes from being a perfect, strong, physical human being to a wrecked body. And she couldn't handle it because she had worshipped herself as being the perfect woman, or at least fighting machines for a woman. And so she couldn't take what that became of her. And so she had to... He wanted to kill herself. I had several clients who'd been like that. One gentleman who was a very successful man. In fact, he was telling me about the beginning of America. I make it sound like I'm like 100 years old. He was working with Mr. Firestone, Firestone Tires. And that was like the whole game in town, tires. And tires used to be made of rubber from South America. And they may still be, but he said they made it almost purely out of rubber. Why did they do that? Because they would wear out quickly. You know, 5,000-10,000 miles, he needed new tires. And he could sell you more tires. He thought that was really cool. And he was telling me about, you know, hanging out with Mr. Firestone, Mr. Ford, all these famous inventors, what that was like. And so he had quite a life. And he wanted to retire to fishing in Homosassa, Florida. So he did retire there. He was a very wealthy man living there at the... You know, he would call me up and I said, how are you doing? He'd go, oh, I'm doing pretty well. It's in the late 80s at this point. But my knees are getting a little stiff. And I go, oh, okay. He goes, yeah, it's getting hard for me getting out of my boat every day. He goes, oh, that's too bad. He goes, I can't tell you. I've got to go out fishing. Well, found about a month later, he decides to take his own life because he couldn't fish the way he wanted to fish. And going, oh my gosh, the guy was a complete atheist. He didn't believe in God. He didn't understand he worshiped but the way he lived his life. It's a disordered way of viewing things. Everybody has value. The other way of looking at that would be like plastic surgery, having lots of excessive plastic surgery to do things to alter your appearance because you want to look perfect all the time. Another respect for health? Temperance. All things in moderation. The abuse of alcohol, food, gambling, medication can cause great harm to our bodies and to others by irresponsible behavior. Drugs, use of medication for non-therapeutic reasons can cause great harm to the body, and participation in the legal drug trade causes harm to others as well as scandal by participating in evil. Respect for the person and scientific research. Scientific study of the human body can bring great benefits to humanity and represents man's dominion over the advances and leading to advances in healthcare. Risks leading to physical or psychological harm associated with human experimentation must be proportional to the benefits. Experimentation on humans during World War II by the Nazis led to a great deal of human medical information, but the ends didn't justify the means. In the Philippines, a Japanese medical worker commented later on the experimentation on prisoners of war, and the great horrors, seeing how long people can live without skin or certain organs. Likewise, Germany, the Nazis, experimented on pregnant women to see the effects of maternal starvation in the development of the unborn child. My father, who's an obstetrician, was telling me about this. What they learned was that, if you take a woman, a Jewish woman, a pregnant woman, and they would see how the children would do if they starved the mother, what that would do to the child. What they found was that there was some effect, but little effect to the child because the mother's body would sacrifice herself to give the child the nutrients it needs to grow to as full a state as possible. So the mother's body was taking more punishment because it was protecting the child. Organ and tissue transplants. Transplant of organs can be a great benefit and represents a sacrifice for the benefit of another. Certain issues must be considered, such as, was the person who donated the organs a willing participant? Were they killed, or was their death accelerated for the purpose? And also, proportionality. If you're going to be donating stuff, your body parts, is that going to put your life in jeopardy? Something has to be considered. Respect for bodily integrity. This is the hot topic today, bodily integrity. Kidnapping, terrorism, obviously are moral, but mutilation, amputation, sterilization of the innocent is immoral except for therapeutic reasons. And so where does that get down to? Well, you think about this whole transgender thing and going through what that does to the body, cutting off body parts, mutilating things, and there's even take it to the extreme of bodily dysmorphia syndrome. Have you ever heard of that? It's this idea, and this sounds like a joke, for people who think that their bodies are not the way they're supposed to be. Example would be there was a gentleman in England who thought he had too many legs. And he needed to have one of his legs removed. Was there anything wrong with his leg? No. But his view was the leg, he had one too many legs. He wanted his leg cut off. So what is the argument? So what would the argument be? Most people, this guy needs psychological counseling. You don't cut off healthy organs. This was in England. So what did the English say? The English thought, well, this guy's going to hurt himself. He's not going to do it right. So we ought to help him. So he had his legs cut off. This is the idea that if you have a mental disease, that's normal. What is the cause of this mental disease? Somebody needs to figure out. I'm really cheery, am I not? There we go. body supporting torture, which uses physical or moral violence to extract confessions, punishing the guilty, frighten opponents, or to satisfy vengeance against an enemy, is morally wrong. Respect for the dead. Dying should be treated with respect and dignity and prepared for death with the proper sacraments and prayers of relatives. The bodies of the dead should be treated with respect. The burial of the dead is a corporal work of mercy. It honors the children of God who are temples of the Holy Spirit. Autopsies are legitimate for scientific inquest. Donation of organs of the dead is appropriate, even meritorious, but please make sure they're dead first. That was added. That actually isn't in the catechism. The church permits cremation as long as it is not a sign of disbelief in bodily resurrection. Now, this is interesting because up till, I think, the 1960s, there was no cremation for Catholics. And so the church does teach this. This is Canon Law 1176, number 3. The church recommends the pious custom of burial be retained, but does not forbid cremation. So we had a wonderful parishioner here. Did you know Ann Bow? Did you know Ann?
No.
Ann was, she was a flight attendant, actually. But she injured herself, and she, I forget what, she dislocated her knee, but she never got rehab, so she never learned how to walk correctly. She was with a walker, and she ended up gaining a lot of weight, and so she could barely get around. And she eventually dropped dead in her mid-60s, when she was always in church, always praying, and yet we all remembered her real well. Well, she passed away, and her family came to claim her body, but mainly to claim her inheritance. And so, we here at the church called up the family and said, "Oh, by the way, when is her funeral?" It was just, many weeks after she died. And they go, "Well, we had her cremated. It was only $200. And she's in a jar. And we're probably going to scatter along 95. And so we're going, no. Bring her back here. We're going to have a funeral for her here. And we're going to give her a proper burial." And so it's really neat. So she ended up, there's a convent out in near Gainesville. Maybe you've heard of it. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But they have this ministry that these nuns do, where they have a ciborium where they put cremated remains. And a nun every day goes and prays for each person who has died. And you go, what a terrific, all of us are going, I don't want to be cremated, but this would be so cool to have a nun praying for us every single day. That would be an awesome thing.
Benedictine Sisters of Virginia in Gainesville and the Place of Peace Columbarium.
There we go. Right there. Yeah, check me out. I didn't make it. But we all loved Anne so much, and she had her family, and her family treated her that way. This was it's such a fantastic situation for her. But the idea that the respect for our bodies are the temples of the Holy Spirit, that our stewards, our remains, have to be honored, which is part of life, is to honor the dead and the remains of the dead. Safeguarding peace. Okay, here we go. One of the positive aspects of avoiding killing is the promotion of peace. One way to promote peace is to avoid anger. And for the promotion, avoiding anger, for the promotion of revenge or to do evil. However, anger to seek restitution for an evil act, like John Paul, going to visit an assassin shortly after his death, is a good thing. And I'll get to my life story. I worked at a bank and I would do trusts and estates. And a long time ago, I had a flight attendant as a client, and she had her father set up trust for her, and I was her trust officer. But it turns out that on her just for her 40th birthday, her 50th birthday, she decided to have some routine cosmetic stuff done to her. And it ended up that, the situation was they put her on conscious sedation, they're going to do some laser on her eyes, they could get rid of the lines, and she would look great. And the business model was that they wanted to take day spas, which were all over this time in Atlanta, and make this like a franchise like McDonald's, where you can just go here, have some routine, small, minor plastic surgery or procedure, and then you'll be out the same day. I was going, this is great. They forecasted millions and millions of dollars. Well, this lady was first patient, first day. They gave her the conscious sedation to make her a little drowsy. A bad reaction, shut down her heart, blows. She was dead. All over the news, CNN, everything. At that point, I was on my honeymoon, just got married. In fact, this lady, her name is Judy. Judy found out I was getting married. She gave me my first wedding gift, and and I arrived home, and her boyfriend was the 777 guy, and he called me while I was at the airport. I checked in, and hey, anything happening? Yeah, call Phil. So I picked up the phone and called Phil, and he goes, she's dead. I'm going, oh no. Then he told the story, and so we, obviously, took care of situations. There were lots of things because this guy, this doctor, kills me. He gets on television saying, oh yeah, she was in there, sounded like consents, terrible things happened, tried to revive her. He lied about everything. There was no consents. He forged her signature. He had no equipment to save her. He was totally lying. And he did it on film. it was a trial, we call it a tort attorney's dream to see this kind of terrible things happen. But the good thing about this, though, this is a terrible tragedy, was that we used this to enact laws in Georgia so that they couldn't do that kind of anesthesia in offices unsupervised without qualified people. They call it Judy's Law. In fact, like when she, the day they had a funeral, there's so many people from Delta that they had to, they had to put a stop to who could go to the funeral because they would shut down the airlines. It was such a big deal. But they were able to use that to pass Judy's Law. So that is a situation where they're taking something that was bad and use it to restitution, the anger to fix the situation. Deliberate hatred is contrary to charity when one contemplates doing harm to another. It goes against Christ's teaching, stating that we should love our neighbors and enemies and pray for them. Peace cannot be maintained on earth without safeguarding these things: the goods of persons, free communication, the dignity of persons, promotion of charity and justice, and fraternal love between people. Like we think about our society today, I think we have challenges with some of these issues. Christ is the sign of peace who reconciled men with God. His church is the sacrament of peace in the world. And those who sacrifice for peace are peacemakers. The solidarity movement in the Poland in the 60s and 70s, which brought about the fall of the Berlin Wall. People sacrificed for peace and used peaceful means to obtain justice. Now, avoiding war, because of the loss of life associated with all wars and evils and injustices that accompany, the Church prays that all wars become unnecessary. Nations are allowed to provide for legitimate defense against dangers. And here's what the Church says about wars. It's called the Just War Criterion. In order for a country to defend itself, damage inflicted by the aggressor nation must be projected to be lasting, grave, and certain. All means of resolving injustice must be shown to be impractical or ineffective. There must be serious prospects of success. The use of destructive force must not produce evils and disorders disproportionate to the evil originally inflicted. National authorities have responsibility to make sure that the use of force is for the common good. Nations have the right to impose obligations on citizens to serve their country for national defense and allow for conscientious objectors. Soldiers have an obligation to follow moral laws and must not conform with illicit evils such as genocide, direct killing of civilians, or non-combatants. Accumulation of arms does not justify maintaining peace through the balance of terror, but contributes to brinkmanship, causing tensions that may escalate, resulting in war. We saw the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had the buildup between the U.S. and Russia, and then putting missiles in Cuba. And also World War One. You ever study World War One? Like, what's the cause of World War One? That's such a difficult question to answer. But one of the main causes is that everybody was building up modern militaries. So they had hundreds of thousands of men in military uniform with military toys and nothing to do with it. And then they had these conflicting alliances between obligations between various states. So as soon as one thing happened, triggered a bunch of different chain reactions. One of the big reasons they had these militaries with nothing to do. So it was this idea of building up arms that could bring us peace, will make us better. It ended up leading to World War I. Sales of arms can undermine international order and peace that leads to war. Everything must be done to contribute to mutual trust and to avoid war. Now we're going to get to the positive stuff. Jesus Christ, the positive law of life. I came to bring life, and life, and have it to the fullest. What is different now that the attacks on life come from within the family and within society? Namely, abortion, attacking the child-parent relationship, euthanasia, attacking the elderly, or the children, killing the parent. Homosexual marriage, transgenderism, contraception, divorce, fornication, attacking the marriage bond. These influences are promoted by the state and enacted into law. The culture are promoted as true freedoms, but in the end, they lead to death. The church, the beacon of salvation of life, regarding restoring the life that was lost. Since outside the church, there is no salvation. The church is the body of Christ, and it's one true head, who is the way, the truth, and the life. So we're charged with spreading the light and spreading the truth and bringing the fullness of life that Christ brings to us in the gospel. So now I'm ready for your outstanding questions. All right.
Circumcision considered mutilation?
No. It's actually biblical, yeah. But one of the reasons they say it would be therapeutic because it leads to infection of the male sexual organ is one of the reasons for it. That's a good question. I know that because my dad's a OBGYN and he used to do a ton. For whatever reason, they would have OBGYNs do the circumcisions. I don't know why. He has a whole bunch of these little circumcision kits. And you can only use them once. So they have like all these really fancy tools. That's a great question, though. Linda? Scott?
I don't have any questions.
Scott, too? Well, that's okay, because we all know that Jody is going to bail us out with the perfect question. Yeah. What could I have done better? Did that make sense? Let's talk about it. This whole idea, though, I mean, I look at it as life, culture of life and the culture of death. And the church promotes the culture of life. We seem to be living in this really strange, bizarre culture of death. You think about it, you know, abortion, transgenderism, you know, grooming people for perverse sexual practices in the schools. It's just so much. I mean, consumerism, I mean, just, you know, secularism, things that take us away from the life of Christ cause our countenance to fall. What do you think? Is that way off base, or is...
I don't think so. I think you're right on the money.
Well, come on, somebody that stirred me up.
Of course, that's how long has that been going on, because it seems like it just came out in the past few years.
Which one?
The one about the school and children.
Oh, it's been going on for 30 years.
And it just seems to be out in the open public within the last few years as far as being.
You know why? COVID, they got to actually see what's happening in the parents.
That's a big part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen overnight. Like, when I was in school, there was some of this stuff, but nothing like what's going on today. But obviously I wasn't in school all that time in between, but it seems like if it got a little worse each year, you'd be about where it is now.
So this is 14 years ago. I went to my niece's high school in Connecticut. It's considered one of the best high schools. I think it's a great school. But lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, questioning and allied, resource guide. So you can learn how to be one of these things. And here's a resource guide for doing that. This is what was in the school. You know my parents knew about this? They didn't know about it. You have fact sheets. Here's your step-by-step, how do you, somebody says something about it. Here, how do you fill out a discrimination complaint? How do you fill out a harassment complaint? The checklist. They got the whole thing to take down whoever says that you're expresses traditional Christian values. It's been going on for at least 30 years. It's been like really gradual. That's why I thought it was interesting when I mentioned that those teachers in LA who were caught on videotape, teaching you how to do sexual grooming of kids. It's sexual grooming of kids. It really is.
When I went to high school in California, when I went there, they had normal sex education class where they taught, man, woman, and what happens for that. And that's the way I was brought up. So all the time since I went to school back in the 70s.
It's even like in companies now. Companies should be conservative. Like, in order for your stock to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange, you have to have what do they call it? I forget the acronym, but essentially you have to have something like equity, environmental, and then governance. Rules. So you have to be a certain type of green. You have to be a certain type of diversity. So if you don't have a board that is made up of certain flavors of people, then they're not going to list you. And if you don't have certain governance things, which stuff like this, they're not going to list you. So they're going to penalize you if you don't have these things. Like, I see it happen in my company overnight. It went from being really conservative. In fact, it was interesting. I saw an interview with the CEO, and the CEO had a one-on-one interview. This was after the riots 2 years ago, the guy who was killed by the
Floyd
riots. So he had this head of the Ford Foundation, the Henry Ford Foundation. It was an African-American guy. He's an attorney, and he was he's also gay. And he was telling him what this white CEO, what he had to have in his board and in his company. He says, you guys have got a lot of diversity, but you don't have enough diversity at these levels. So you've got to have, change this stuff around. And so, you see all of a sudden a lot of the white guys getting fired, the people who weren't white being put in their place, and then very few promotions of the guys who are white. So it was changing things around really, really, really quickly. And then what I actually wanted to see, what does the Ford Foundation say? And they show the groups that they support, the groups that are on there, and they measured everything by melatonin in the skin and gender. And then also, your sexual preferences and your, whatever you transform yourself or your sexual orientation you think you are. Mm-hmm. So it's, they're pushing it full scale. And who is doing this? Because it doesn't make business sense.
It's happening in the federal government too.
Mm-hmm. And then you're trying to get the little sisters of the poor to have pay for contraception. Why? Why is that? Why take this control? You think contraception, that's optional.
It's female contraception, and what does female contraception do? It shuts down normally functioning organs, or suppresses them. That's not a right. Ooh, over time.
Sorry. Just barely.
Sorry about that. But anyway, that's. Should we want to end in a prayer?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that'll be a good one. Well, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, amen. Dear God, thank you for the gathering of this class today. For Alexa, for Melinda, for Ray, for Jody, and for Scott, who hopefully will be coming into the church. We pray for them. And Lord, we look out for them for the great hope that, that we look for in the church. Like the not-so-humble Irish priest, Dagger John, who was able to change society through education, through the right teachings of the culture of life. We ask, Lord, for your blessing on everyone here, that this culture of life, which you have given to us, will once again flourish in our society, and our society will again be great. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
All right. Well, thank you. Everyone have a great week.